Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course, I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Not much, man. I'm very, very, very excited for this one.
As am I. Joining us today on the show is a screenwriter and director, Peter Iliff, a name many movie fans will likely recognize as he's the guy responsible for writing one of the greatest action films of all time, Point Break, which was directed by Kathryn Bigelow and still stands as one of her best pieces of action filmmaking. The film has become a clear favorite with audiences for years, and it's one of those movies that Frank and I have seen so many times we've probably got most of it committed to memory. Peter's other screenwriting credits include the Jack Ryan adventure Patriot Games, audience favorite Varsity Blues, and the underrated Stephen Hopkins thriller Under Suspicion. His directorial debut came in 2012 with the horror thriller Rites of Passage, which is a pretty nasty little flick. And he's got a number of exciting projects on the horizon, which we'll talk to him about. And being that Frank and I are both big fans of action movies in general, this is a real treat to be joined by the creator of one of our absolute favorite entries in the action genre with Point Break. So we can't wait to talk to him about his thoughts on the genre as a whole. So welcome to the show, Peter. It's an honor to have you with us tonight for a chat. Thanks a lot.
That's great to be on. And I love it. You mispronounced my name. It's like the street I live on. I actually live on Islet Street in the Pacific Palisades. Isn't that a kick? The mailman is always going. Yeah. It's like, they always go, wow, did they name it after you? And I just go, absolutely.
That was my question. I should have asked you in the preamble if it was.
No, it's totally fine. I've grown up my entire life having every teacher and every class I ever took, Peter Iliff. No, it's Iliff.
And in the credits.
Anyway, great to meet you guys and talk movies. And thanks for all the kind words about Point Break. It's sure been good to me, that movie. No, sure been good to me.
That's awesome. I just, like Nick said, I've watched that movie countless times, and I just watched it again tonight for the prep. Man, that movie. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say we can't forget that Mr. James Cameron did an unaccredited rewrite of the draft. You know, Jim Cameron, who produced the movie, he was married to Kathryn Bigelow at the time, and he did a draft. Actually, Jim took me on a surfing safari one day with Kathryn out to Malibu. We went all through it, and then he actually rented a little place out there, and he did a draft, and he kind of turbocharged the script. And, he added that scene that, I don't know how I feel about the infamous jumping out of the plane without a parachute. That's Jim Cameron. He said to me, I was flying in a plane over Spain. I guess he just finished posting The Abyss. And he said, I had this idea while I was flying over Spain that if you jumped out of a parachute with a gun, how would you, if you were to catch up with Bowie, how would you pull your ripcord? And so out of this ridiculous idea came the scene. But I always want to thank Jim because I was lucky enough to win sole credit in the arbitration because, as you know, it was an original screenplay and the guild really protects the original writer. And I'm very thankful for that, I can tell you a whole bunch of things. I was a young man in my mid-20s and I was waiting tables and I was determined to make it in Hollywood and I would actually finish a waiting table shift and put money into the ATM and I would go home and write. And, I sold this script. I mean, it changed my life. It was that quantum leap. We sold it to whole people, Ridley Scott, who had just come off of making Someone to Watch Over Me, his fifth film. But I mean, here I am, waiting tables trying to write screenplays, and frickin' Ridley Scott, who just did Alien, did Blade Runner, has just bought my script. Are you kidding? It was the most exciting time of my life. And unfortunately, that version of the film did not get made. It was going to star Charlie Sheen as Johnny Utah, James Garner as Pappas, and the film, apparently David Putnam got fired and it was Columbia Pictures, and then Don Siegel came in, and in one day's time, Ridley Scott left to do the Paramount picture, Black Rain, and he had Michael Douglas. So I remember they had taken 5 months to build all the sets, and in half a day, they were all torn down. These are Ridley Scott sets. These are, you know, big-ass sets, right? And I was just a wreck. I was, you know, I was beside myself. And I remember my agent goes, Peter, I got some bad news. Your movie just got canceled, and we've got about a half hour before the town knows, and we've got to get you a job so we can establish your quote. Because if you know anything about screenwriting salaries, when you sell a script, that's one number, but that's not your quote when you're hired. That's, you know, it's a work for hire quote. And so they got me within a half hour a job from at Warner Brothers to rewrite a script for $100,000. And that was, I took it, and that was my first quote. And then 4 years later, Point Break got made, of course, Larry Gordon's first film at Largo. And I'm just very grateful. It's been very good to me in my life. You know, a lot of people have said a lot of nice things. At first, Hollywood did not like the film very much. They seemed to like the screenplay better. It was much, because, you know, Jim Cameron turbocharged it, and Hollywood kind of turned their nose up to it. But over the years, I started to realize people seem to really like this film. I don't think they're just blowing smoke up my butt. I think they really like it. And then more years go by, and suddenly there's this play in, you know, in L.A. It's been going 9 years, Point Break Live. It's been in, you know, San Francisco and Las Vegas. It's been in New York City. I mean, like, I guess people like this freaking movie, you know? So just very, very grateful. And my hat's off to Kathryn Bigelow, because when you watch the film, it kind of stands the test of time. It doesn't seem too terribly dated, does it?
No, not whatsoever.
Yeah, it's really a tribute to her, yeah.
What I wanted to ask you is, like, you mentioned Cameron polished it, which I didn't know. Mm-hmm. And I think James Cameron's awesome. I love yeah. Cameron. But, I mean, James Cameron didn't, like, conceive Johnny Utah, though, right?
No, of course
you know,
not.
I mean, it was seriously,
it was original
that name,
screenplay. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that name is so great.
Well, you know, I'm a 49er fan, so Joe Montana, Johnny Utah. I figured that out in about 90 seconds. And, I mean, it was that simple. It was like, I was like, you know, I share credit with a guy named Rick King. Rick King is a great director that I had met, and he came to me with this idea. Hey, I got this idea about surfers who rob banks. And he had, like, their, you know, so some detective goes back to high school, and you know, they paid me a whopping $5,000 to write this script. And so Rick and I were, Mrs. Beckman, we were smoking a joint. It was like, you know, John, Montana, Utah. So it was a lot of fun. We did three drafts of the script while I was indeed waiting tables. And that $5,000 was a world of money to me as a waiter. And then it indeed sold to Columbia and Ridley Scott, and it just changed my life, you know. And the remake is coming out, you know.
Yeah, before we delve into the remake, which I know Frank and I want to talk about, Frank and I were chatting before about the fact that Ridley Scott was the one to purchase the script, and we both said, Frank said initially, I can't believe it wasn't Tony Scott, because the material just feels, you know, not that Ridley wouldn't have knocked it out of the park. I'm sure he would have. It just feels like Tony Scott bread and butter material, like through and through, high concept action film in the 90s. You know, I'm sure I would wonder what that could have been like. But having said that, huge fan of Kathryn Bigelow, her aesthetic, the sense of kinetic action is always apparent in every movie. And there's nothing like Point Break. Like you said, it doesn't feel dated, but then again, when you watch it, you can't help but know that you're seeing something made in a different time, in a different era, when you could make an action film, an R-rated action film, a high concept movie that didn't cost $150 million, and, you know, the pre-CGI realm of getting things done. And I just, you know, forgive me for the flip out here on Point Break, but it's just It's so fucking awesome, and it's always awesome. The action scenes, the characters, the dialogue, the plotting. You know, Hollywood may have turned its nose up at the finished product, as you said. I wouldn't really know. I mean, I know what you read online from critics and, you know, box office stats, but that movie has taken on a life of its own over the years. It really is amazing.
Yeah, it was like they have in the TV guide, or there's a 4-star system. There used to be. It was always a 2-star movie, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, it's just 2-star movie, but people seem to like it, so that's cool, you know. I would like to say something about Bigelow's direction, and it's fun when you look at these films. Look at the bank robbery scenes and realize there are all these really sophisticated swish pan moves, and basically
it's incredible.
The camera is swish panning to point A, the actor does something, and then the actor moves, the swish pans to point B, connects with that actor, that something happens, the swish pans again to point C, and then point D and on. So these were very, very sophisticated and heavily worked out camera moves, and I'd never seen anything like it. And it's really something. It gave these bank robbery scenes a real kinetic feel that, really, you know, the master shot was like a, you know, 25-second swish pan, swish pan, swish pan, swish pan. And then you would start cutting in tighter. But it was a real piece of filmmaking. And another thing that's to her credit is that Keanu Reeves, who I think was fabulous with the film. I mean, I've heard all the jokes about his acting, but I think he was great because in a lot of the scenes, he doesn't react. Like, for example, when he meets Swayze on the beach, and Swayze makes fun of my, you know, so-and-so had a surfboard like this, you know, like a, you know, size of a couch or whatever. I should know my own lines, but I'm stumbling on it. But if you notice, Keanu doesn't react. I mean, he just gives him a look. And that's a very powerful choice for an actor to make, just to respond with a look, because it gives you power. You know, if you say something, you deflated the power. And Keanu had a lot of choices like that that made him powerful, and it was interesting. And Catherine saw this, and here's a guy who just come off of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and who's to think that this guy could exude this kind of, you know, mm-hmm. action movie power? And no one wanted to, you know, hire him, and she had to fight the fight with Larry Gordon, who's made quite a few action films. He's already made Die Hard, and Catherine won the battle, and to her credit, I think it was a great piece of casting. And of course, Swayze was the biggest star on the planet at that time. He just made Ghost, so it was like having the Beatles, you know. And the sets were roped off, and there literally were girls screaming, and it was really kind of a scene, you know.
I can only imagine, and you know, this, like you said, this was pre-speed, pre-cemented box office status for Keanu Reeves, and like you said, coming off of Bill and Ted, and having that stoner, that built-in stoner vibe from that movie, and carrying it over to the surfer aspect to it all. It really was perfect casting, and I'm glad that, you know, everybody went to bat for him, or Catherine Bigelow. What you're saying is that she really, you know, pushed hard for him, and it's great. And the chemistry that he has with you know, Patrick Swayze, it's there, like, it's awesome. Like, you get the angst, you feel the angst when, you know, he's got to do, you know, I don't think I'm spoiling anything, but, you know, when the reversal comes and everything is, you know, laid out on the table, it's really awesome. It makes it that much more dramatically interesting and effective. And to get back to what you're saying about the bank robbery, you're absolutely right. I queued up the movie this morning early, get a good start to the day. And that bank robbery is absolutely ridiculous. And the way that Donald Peterman shot it, with, you said, with the swish panning and the real sense of momentum and real just visceral energy, it's different than a lot of bank robbery sequences. You've seen 100 bank robberies in movies, and everybody loves to do it their own way. And the ones in Point Break have a real edge. They have a real edge. There's like a menacing intensity to them.
Yeah, Catherine is true visionary. And of course, a lot of people reference the chase in the latter half of the movie, you know, where
it's amazing.
They've blown up the car with the flamethrower, you know, gas nozzle. That's the pogo cam. And I guess they kind of invented it. You know, it was like this camera on a, you know, this is before GoPros, right? They had big ass film cameras. and they invented some rig that some guy who had to be really strong arms and legs had to run after these actors with the pogo cam. And that was no small rig, and it was very impressive. And people seem to reference that a lot, but I always found the sorry, my phone is making sound. I always thought the bank robbery scenes were amazing. What else can I tell you about that film? There was a very funny moment I always loved. Catherine is not, she's not a sports fan. You know, she's a model, artist, filmmaker. So when it came to the football at the beach scene, I'll never forget. We're filming this out by in Malibu, a place called Leo Carrillo Beach, and before the shoot, I see her kneeling in the sand with Jim Cameron, who is basically drawing football plays in the dirt or in the sand. It's like, oh yeah, I can just imagine, honey, can you just help me with this one scene because I know nothing about football. And to her credit, she shot a great football scene, especially when Utah gets tackled by, Swayze gets tackled by Utah into the breaking wave. It's a great shot.
I
always love that scene.
Yeah, the cinematography in the film is, again, it I can't stress this enough. I'm 35 years old. The bread and butter action movies from the 80s and 90s that I grew up with, they looked like action movies. They had a look and feel. There was that cinema sheen to them. They had that sense of just not being too over the top, but not so. This is all pre computers. And I guess we'll talk about the remake coming up in a little bit, and we can talk about what seemingly looks like a lot of CGI in that one as opposed to obviously the original
there's
remake.
No CGI. I mean, an example I could give you would be they had to pay a surfer, they had a thing for $50,000 for that final shot where, Bodie, you fit on the wave, the death wave. And I never thought, I wish they kind of found something bigger, but the fact is there was no CGI. That was a practical shot. They paid a surfer $50,000 to take a dump in that wave. And this was before big wave surfing was invented. I mean, Laird Hamilton would go on to invent toe-in surfing in 93. So these were not toe-in waves. These were, the next generation of big wave surfing was yet to be invented. So it's kind of amazing they got these shots. And so if you had CGI, they would have had a wave the size of a skyscraper. That would have looked stupid, quite frankly. I will say something that's always interesting to talk about with this film, a lot of people don't know, is that the ending was a reshoot. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
No, I did not.
The fight at the beach. Yeah, it's really interesting, and it worked out so well. If you notice, at the end at Bell's Beach, suddenly Keanu Reeves has long hair and Patrick Swayze has short hair. And that's because they had to shoot this thing over about 3 months later. And what had happened is the original scene did not have a fight. Basically, Keanu or Johnny Utah, finds Bodie and says, you got to come in, and he comes in. And then that was it. But no, let me ride the suicide wave. Okay. Larry Gordon saw it saying, no, we need a fight. It's an action movie. And I kind of like his instinct. So if you remember, Swayze had cut his hair and gone off to shoot Roland Joffe's film City of Joy, where he played a doctor in India. And Keanu had gone off to grow his hair to play Bill and Ted 2. So when they came back, they had this different hair, and it was really cool because it kind of showed the passage of time that in the movie it had taken Johnny Utah many months to finally track the guy down. And
right.
So they shot this thing up in Seattle, actually. It wasn't Bell's Beach. They found a beach with dark sand, and they shot this thing. And I've always loved the ending. I still get a chill down my spine when he throws that badge because he ain't coming back. And then they break into that great song by Rat, like the only song by Rat I ever liked, and Nobody Rides for Free. And, and I guess another one, Round and Around, is a pretty good song. But those two are the only Rat songs I ever went anywhere. And I love that song, Nobody Rides for Free. And anyway, I always get a thrill at that scene. A lot of people don't know that.
That's awesome. I had no idea about that. I wanted to ask you the genesis of having the robbers wear president masks. I absolutely love that, and I've loved that as a kid.
Oh, that's cool. You know, it's a simple screenwriting concept. You think about creating something that, okay, they steal money, not money, bank robbers. Okay, then what's on money? Dead presidents. And originally it was like George Washington and, you know, Abe Lincoln, you know, the guys on the real money.
Right.
And then it was actually Jim Cameron going, well, okay, that's cute, but let's actually update the presidents. And so instead of the dead presidents, it became, thanks to Jim Cameron, the ex-president.
Gotcha.
And I think that was a great change. But I had written the dead presidents. And so Jim, now that they were the ex-presidents, he could do that, some of that dialogue he threw in, like, you know, I'm not a crook, you know, the Nixon line.
Yeah, right.
That was Jim. So, you know, it's great. If you're going to be rewritten, it's great having the man do it, Jim Cameron. My hat's off to him.
That's awesome. The movie clearly has a real great sense of surfing and surfing culture. This is something that's a passion for you.
Oh, it's such an embarrassment for me. I mean, I'm a California guy, but I'm a 6'4" skinny geek, and I can only do sports in straight lines. Whenever I try to turn, I basically have a big problem. And so surfing is not ever going to happen for me. I mean, I'm a mediocre paddle boarder, and I love the water. You know, I really do love the boogie board, but I get my butt handed me every time I try to surf. So it's just been kind of this albatross where all these famous producers, like, yeah, you know, you kind of hang with Brian Grazer, go, oh, I got a beach house, why don't you come over and surf? Like, oh God. You know, years ago, I was working with Rob Cohen, whose email literally, you know, rob@surfdga.com. And he's got this house over at Point Doom, and he's got a little go-kart with, it always has surfboards and wetsuits hanging over. He's got basically a surf shop in his garage, and he basically wants to have board meetings. Like, if you work on a script with Rob Cohen, you gotta like go on the surf and you sit in the lineup and talk story. Like, he fucking nearly, I'm sorry, I used a bad word, but he basically,
no, you can swear, man,
there.
You're good,
it's fine.
You know, so it's like, it's been this, like, you know, embarrassment. Like, I wish I could surf, because I keep having to tell people who expect me to be Laird Hamilton that I'm a freaking geek, you know, but I do love the water. And I grew up in Santa Barbara at the school at UCSB, and I was around all the surfers all the time who basically, you know, could not keep steady jobs because when the surf came up, they had to go, you know, go roll. And a lot of these guys were selling dope and they were the criminals because they couldn't hold a steady job. So the whole idea kind of fed out of that, you know, and there's been a lot of famous surfer criminals, you know, Murph the Surf, and, you know, a lot of these guys back in the 60s in Malibu that kind of set the tone for Bodhi for me.
You know? Yeah, you even, in the opening stages of Rites of Passage, you've got a surfing interlude as well. So forgive me for thinking that maybe you were another incarnation of Laird Hamilton or someone like that. But no, the Point Break clearly has a passion for that.
I had shoulder surgery 8 weeks ago from carrying my paddleboard. The wind caught it and I ripped my shoulder, and I literally gave the paddleboard away to a guy named Dennis Jarvis, who runs a surf shop in Newport. And Dennis Jarvis was the guy on Point Break who taught Swayze how to surf. And so I go, Dennis, take this frickin' paddleboard out of my frickin' sight. I'm rip my shoulder. So, yeah, that's me. Anyway, what else you want to ask me about Point Break?
Oh, my God.
All right, since we're still on the Point Break subject, I wanted to ask you about the sequel that apparently was supposed to come out in, like, I can't remember if it was the early 2000s or late 90s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was hired. Well, let me back up. It's an interesting story because Largo went bankrupt, and in the 11th hour, a lawyer, a business affairs person at large named Chris Taylor, he bought the rights to Point Break and some other properties. I think Time Cop was one of them. And The Watchmen, which got made, was one of them. He bought this in the 11th hour, these titles, by putting his house, by mortgaging his house. You know, he's got four kids, he put it all at risk, and he got the rights to Point Break. And he then got some money, he hired me for a lot of money to basically write and direct the sequel. And this is about 6-7 years ago, and we had this great trip all through Indonesia, because we were going to call it Point Break Indo. And it was basically going to be, Bodhi did survive the wave, and now he's a bit of a Robin Hood out in Indonesia with his, now his sons. And they're kind of like monkey wrenchers, you know, kind of, you know, saving the planet out there. And not Johnny Utah, but a new character who is a, like a, you know, a Navy guy who surfs, who becomes like a mercenary, basically gets hired to track them down. And like Johnny Utah, when he finds them, he realizes these are kinship brothers and I got to protect them, not do them in. So it's kind of like doing the same movie, the same vibe, but having it all new and making it big wave surfing and snowboarding and wingsuit jumping and chasing motorcycles. And you know, I got rewritten 1,000 times and a lot of different directors. I mean, I was no longer the director. And then they finally decided to do a remake. And, you know, Kurt Rimmer apparently wrote this on spec. You know, so good for Kurt. He was always a real big fan of Point Break. And he's been nothing but very kind to me and always reaching out. And they have done a really, you know, like a very different reimagination of Point Break. It is no longer a Southern California surf bank robbery movie. It is something very different. It's a big international gang who are chasing the eight, which are these eight mystical athletic feats that allowed them to get in the wingsuit jumping and the, you know, the big wig surfing and you know, snowboarding with snorkels because the snow is so deep you can't breathe, and you know, free solo climbing and a bunch of cool stuff. And it's Johnny Utah, you know, the FBI has got to go get him. And it's the same story, but it's not necessarily surfing, and it's certainly not set in Southern California. And it will be, you know, the second unit guy is a dear friend, Phil Boston, and he shot the living shit out of this movie. They had $120 million to shoot this stuff practical. So again, they pride themselves of having assembled the best stunt people on the planet and had the budget to do it. And it's going to be something to put on your 3D goggles and watch this film. I'll tell you that much. It opens against Star Wars on Christmas Day. Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but I'm seeing Star Wars at midnight.
Yeah, maybe it's brilliant. Maybe like after you see Star Wars a third time, you'll go see Point Break. You know, I don't know.
Or for the people when they get to the theater and Star Wars is sold out.
There you go.
It's just one of those things for me. I just the first movie is just it's a classic on both a nostalgic level and in the moment level, because you could have, if someone's never seen the original Point Break and you put it on right now and they're a fan of the action genre, then I would have questions if they were not satisfied. Having said that, there's plenty of people who aren't familiar with the original Point Break and who have become very, very much attuned to extreme sports. Because one of the things I loved about Point Break is that, like, it really was just obviously focusing on the surfing angle. It wasn't like an extreme sports competition angle in that film, but the movie does have a sort of, you know, like a bent towards extreme sports before, if I'm not mistaken, predating the X Games and the whole explosion of, you know, that sort of lifestyle.
Yeah.
So there's something unique about the original film in that sense. And here with the sequel, from what you're saying, it sounds like they're really going to take advantage of the worldwide explosion of these kind of sports and turn it into something interesting. I want to say one thing, because you mentioned that you're friends with Rob Cohen. I got a giggle because, of course, Rob Cohen directed The Fast and the Furious, the first one, which many people consider to be a reimagining in some respects of Point Break.
Well, you know, Rob is a friend, and I remember back then, you know, I know Rob before he made the film, and he actually called me. He said, hey, you know, he just copped to it. I forget exactly what he said, but he copped to it in a friendly way, and I really appreciate him making that phone call. You know, it's a nice thing to do. So I've never it's an honor to be, you know, it's an honor. I mean, essentially, we did not make up, you know, I did not make up the idea of, you know, the ending of Point Break. That's a ripoff from the great Kurosawa films, you know, Samurai Honor. You know, all this stuff gets remade and remolded. And Jim Cameron said to me, you know, steal from the best. And I've used that as a mantra in screenwriting ever since. You know, we're basically recycling a lot of great ideas, and it's an honor.
I think it's a testament too about how that formula has worked, and about, again, about how successful and how much people enjoy, you know, enjoy Point Break. So certainly Frank and I will check out the sequel, and we'll go into it with, you know, with open eyes, and we'll give it a fair shot, but it's going to be tough to live up to the original, because the original is really, it's movie magic of the sort that really isn't getting, you know, made. And, I sort of want to maybe bounce around if we can, because one of your other bigger credits from the 90s was Patriot Games. I wanted to ask how you got involved in Patriot Games, because Frank and I are both big fans of the Jack Ryan series, especially Patriot Games, Hunt for Red October, Clear and Present Danger, those three. How did you get involved with that world?
Well, this was the second one, or the first film was Alec Baldwin, and I was actually in Berlin on some writing gig. And I remember I literally got a telegram. And I got a telegram at my hotel on the Kudamm in Berlin saying, you got the job. And I guess, you know, when Point Break was about to come out, it kind of made me a hotter commodity. So, you know, they always hired the sexy writer. So that was a year of my life, and it was a great year. And, you know, Alec Baldwin was the star of Patriot Games. And Alec, we were writing it for Alec, who is obviously 15 years younger than Harrison. And if I remember correctly, Alec Baldwin was asking to push the movie so he could do A Streetcar Named Desire on Broadway. And I go, oh, okay. The writer's always the last to know. And then in a weekend, all of a sudden, Alec Baldwin was out and Harrison Ford was in. Harrison Ford was already signed to a movie on the lot called Night Train, to be directed by Harold Porter, I believe, if I'm saying the name right. And that movie fell out, and Harrison took the role of Jack Ryan. And that happened in a weekend. And because he's now, at that time, was a 50-year-old man, we had to rewrite the movie to accommodate him. And you see it actually in a sequence in Patriot Games where he's walking out of the front gate of the Annapolis Naval Academy, and he gets in that fight with that assassin. Remember that? It's a really cool scene where he kind of like sees the guy coming, he kind of ducks behind
right.
the truck.
Right, yeah. Sees him in the rear view.
Yeah, and you know, think about it. Harrison was very upfront about it. He goes, I am not Indiana Jones here. I mean, you know, I need to kind of be in trouble here. My character is a 50-year-old man. He's not in the CIA at this point. He's probably not going to win this fight. And I thought, how cool that you have a big enough, you're secure enough in your ego to allow yourself to be less than Indiana Jones right now, because you're absolutely right. It's better for the role. And so I always respected Harrison Ford for that kind of input. And my favorite story and my favorite lesson from Harrison Ford is the scene in Patriot Games where, Admiral Greer, James Earl Jones, brings him into that CIA war room where they can watch the satellite feed of the SIS, you know, troops going in to blow out that camp in Libya. That's the scene that was not in the book. I wrote that scene, so I'm always very proud of that scene. But after the scene is over, you know, the Admiral Greer goes to Harrison Ford, hey, how do you feel? You know, and Harrison Ford has about, you know, seven lines of dialogue. I feel pretty good about this, or, you know, I have mixed emotions, or whatever he said. Because in a screenplay, you kind of have to write that so the actor, the studio, the director kind of know how the guy feels. And Harrison Ford goes, remove all the dialogue and just put the camera on me. So Admiral, if you watch the film, Admiral Greer goes, hey, you know, hey, how do you feel? And it's just a look. And the look is so much better than any writer could have written. And that's a great example of great, I don't know if great screenwriting, but great movie making, because I do think as a writer, you have to write it down for the executives and the producers, but it's a great thing to cut out and just let the director, sorry, let the actor emote, especially if they're an actor of that, you know, caliber. You know, he's a very good actor, Harrison Ford. He's a,
yeah.
One last thing about Harrison is he's a guy who memorizes the name of everybody on the set. I'm talking the grips. I'm talking the caterers. He knows everybody's name. The guy must have a photographic memory. He's awesome. Everybody loves him because of that.
That's so great to hear, because I've always, like, even as a kid, I've loved Harrison Ford. He's always been one of my all-time favorite actors. I mean, the guy's played some of the most iconic characters ever, and especially those that are seminal to my childhood. And I mean, you know, I'm 30, so, you know, Jack Ryan's one of them. I can't remember how many times I watched Patriot Games on VHS.
Well, you know, what's funny is that I had worked with Ridley Scott for many months on what was going to become Point Break. And, you know, being a fan, I'd always ask him stories like, you know, how did you do Alien? How did you do Blade Runner? And he would tell me the stories of Harrison Ford having a serious addiction problem, and not coming out of his trailer, and being a big son of a bitch on Blade Runner. So this is the Harrison Ford I think I'm getting, and he couldn't have, you know, he'd obviously gotten control of his demons, and he couldn't have been a more lovely person, you know, and a very, very bright person. Another story that I would share, which is really interesting. You can imagine on a film like Patriot Games, which is the second in a series, a very high budget film for Paramount. They see this as a tentpole franchise. So the stunts are worked out months in advance with the best stuntman and best, you know, crews you can. Meaning every action scene is storyboarded. And so one day Harrison Ford comes in and says, here are my storyboards. He had hired a storyboard artist, and he had basically reconceived many of the action scenes, including the opening one, which, remember, he walks into the Irish terrorists trying to kill some royals. He basically rewrote every shot of that action sequence, and I'll never forget the look on Philip Noyce's face, because, you know, Philip was a newer director at the time, and he couldn't. He didn't have the power to tell Harrison Ford to go take a hike. And I remember, I'm like on the set in London filming that sequence. And if you remember, there's the two royals who are going to be, you know, Edward J. Fox or whoever was they were going to kill, were sitting in a car. And they're going to shoot up that car. And so between takes, Harrison and I would sit in that car alone so he could explain the storyboards to me, because I now had to rewrite the script to match the storyboards so all the various departments of the film could, you know, get the things they needed to write to support the storyboards. And in those days, you know, like, it was a big deal that there's no Wi-Fi. You had to kind of, like, I'd write this on my old laptop and then go, like, find a printer to print out and make copies. And you know, I remember one time in a scene, Harrison had changed things up, and I had to rewrite it in the fly. And, like, Samuel L. Jackson and, you know, all these people, they literally had to pass my computer around the reading table to read the new lines, because there was no way to Wi-Fi to a printer, to, you know, to iPads. It was really funny. So they're, like, passing my computer around with the new lines, and they're making it work. And it was very funny, you know. And I think it wasn't a tip, but I think it was actually a shoot. They had to pass the computer around, and then they shot the scene. That was the scene in the house at the dinner table at the end when all of a sudden they realize that the attack's going on. So
yeah,
a lot of funny things going on with the technology of at the time that made things a lot different. You know what I mean? So,
oh, I can only imagine. I mean, like, oh. I like the faxing of pages. I can imagine back in the day.
Oh God, you had to, you know, back in the day, you know, I always lived in the West Side in Santa Monica or the Palisades of Malibu, and you know, you couldn't email your script in. There was no PDF attachment, so they had to send a runner to your house to get the script, and of course, you'd wait in the last second to hit the print button because you're busy writing. And you know, this poor son of a bitch is driven over here, and like this, you know, remember you had those dot matrix printers that take an hour, and it's 2 pages a minute. So this son of a bitch has to wait in your house for an hour for this thing to print. And like, you know, hey, you want a sandwich? You want a beer? You know, you want you know? But I wanted to tell you one other fun fact about that movie, which was, again, the ending was changed. You know, they had the full audience preview, and they hire specialists to kind of, you know, interview the audiences. And the audience did not like the ending. And the ending, if you remember, is the bad guy, Sean Bean, after the fight on the boat on fire, basically gets a anchor through his heart. And then Harrison jumps off the boat, and the boat crashes in the rocks. That's the ending that you saw in the theater. The original ending, because Philip Noyce, you know, being this kind of interesting filmmaker who likes things more subtle, had a shot where both Sean Bean and Harrison Ford fall. You know, the boat crashes. They're now sinking. It's an underwater shot. They're at each other's throats. It's kind of a long shot underwater, and you don't know who's who. And one sinks down to the bottom and one rises to the surface. So the surprise is, who will it be at the surface? Oh, it's Jack Ryan. And that shot, well, very arty, and you can see the screenwriter's director, oh, what a cool, clever, artistic ending. It did not have the kinetic energy, you know, a fight and getting your heart pierced with an anchor. So you know, another example of the $2 million reshoot.
Yeah. And you know, Philip Noyce has been a director, been a fan of for a while, and he's had an interesting career where he's made these really awesome, slick Hollywood action thrillers, but then does more smaller personal stuff like Rabbit Proof Fence, you know, The Quiet American, Catch a Fire. He's just been a really, really interesting filmmaker throughout the years. And I always thought
he did such a
bang up job with Patriot Games and with Clear and Present Danger. I thought both of those movies were really strong. And what I also find very interesting about the Jack Ryan series, I know your involvement with this series, as far as we know from, you know, credit list, was just Patriot Games. Because I know that you've done a lot of uncredited work throughout the years, which is also an interesting area.
I've been hired by studios over 50 times at, you know, six-figure contracts to write movies for studios, because in the 90s, you know, the late 80s, the 90s, and early 2000s, basically,
right. Yeah.
That was the business. You know, they were hiring guys to write movies that never got made, and, you know, guys that made a fortune. So if you look at my IMDb resume, you can see all those scripts that I was hired to write, and it's remarkable. You know,
I had been hired,
you know, of all things, by Tom Clancy and John McTiernan after Patriot Games to co-write a movie with Tom Clancy that never got made at Universal called The Battle of 73 Easting. And it's a great script. It's about a true tank battle, armored U.S. armored cavalry in Iraq. And, so, you know, I went off and took that job, which was actually paying me a lot more money than, and to my mistake, because instead of doing, you know, Clear Present Danger, I did the other one. And, you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But, you know, that was my choice at the time. And I had really become close friends with Tom Clancy, and that kind of estranged me from Philip Noyce a little bit, who was at odds with Tom Clancy. You know, they saw things very, very differently, those two gentlemen.
Yeah, I can sort of imagine the differences in of opinion. I mean, I don't know either one of them, obviously, but I just from what I know about them and their work, they seem like they would be two polar opposites, which is interesting. And one of the things I find so interesting about the series, Hunt for Red October was a PG-rated movie. Patriot Games is rated R. Clear and Present Danger is PG-13. It's been like unique sense of like Patriot Games really does feel like the most hardcore, the most even the most adult. I mean, they all feel adult, of course, but Patriot Games has like the edge. I mean, really, it does. I mean, it's like the meanest.
It's a great
one out
story.
Of the US.
I mean, if you remember with Clear and Present Danger, the problem with that book was it's a four quadrant book. It's got four characters. It's got Clark. It's got Jack Ryan. It's got Adam Greer. So the trick was how you make it one screenplay, and they had to really depart from the book to do it. Patriot Games, which was in fact Clancy's first novel of the series, of course, The Hunt was the first that got published, and to success, I believe. But Patriot Games is a great story. I mean, like, what do you do if you stop a terrorist and they go after your family? You know, and what's the Faustian bargain that you make? So it's a great story to tell. And all I had to do was to really, because Donald Stewart came in first, who had worked on the first movie, and they hired me to rewrite Donald Stewart. And it's funny, he gets first position credit, or I know I get first position credit, because the Guild said they wanted to honor me because I did most of the work. But it looks like Stewart rewrote me. He came first, I came in second, and then Steve Zalian was brought on along with me. I was never let go. They had Steven Zalian come on to work on scenes while I was working on other scenes for the last month or so. It was kind of interesting, and Steve Zalian is one of the very best, and that's why there's a scene when Dr.
Yeah,
Zalian
he's incredible.
Calls. And, and Steve's a great guy, you know. Harrison Ford basically said, and he said, when I do a movie, I demand to have an Oscar-winning screenwriter. Come on. That's just the way it is. So, but it was kind of cool that they didn't fire me. They kept me on. And so I was the one who was on set in London. I was the one on set, in Annapolis. And I always thought that was really nice of Harrison. Because I think he liked me, and I think that was I'm going to bring on Zalian, but you're not going anywhere, bro. We're just going to kind of all do this together. And I thought that was very sweet. That was very cool.
It's awesome.
An honorable thing to do.
That's way cool.
There was a great moment too. Like, there was a sequence in the film that was the first week of shooting. It was the sequence in London where Polly Walker kind of comes into the bookstore, and Paramount did not like the way Noyce shot it, so they made Philip Noyce reshoot the entire first week of his shooting. Okay, and this had a ramification on the film, because the film had a major sequence removed to pay for that 1 week of reshoots, and that sequence was a big set piece action scene in the first act where the terrorist, Sean Bean, tries to kill the judge. And it was a great sequence because you see these terrorists coming in to get the judge in the Old Bailey as Harrison Ford's testifying and how he's actually walking out of the courthouse. And you think they're going to kill Harrison Ford, but instead they're going to kill the judge because they think that will cause a mistrial. And it's this great sequence. And they told me on a Sunday morning, Peter, don't say a word, but cut it out and make it work so we can just lose these 10 pages. Don't bitch, don't moan, nothing you or I can do, just make it happen. And I was like, oh, you're cutting out that sequence? And, so whenever I see Patriot Games, I think the first act is rather slow. And it is, because it's missing a huge action sequence that, would have been as good as any of the sequences in the film. It was, we'd spent months working on it. And But that was because the studio felt Noyce had blown the first week of shooting, made them redo it again, and thus they had to recoup the money elsewhere.
Unreal.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe they don't want that story told, but that's a true story.
I wanted to briefly, real quick, I wanted to ask you about Under Suspicion.
My
favorite
film.
Yeah, that's a film that I absolutely love,
yeah.
And I think that that film is vastly underseen. You know what? Nick and I are going to do a podcast on that movie.
It's good. And,
you know, it'd be great because it'd be great to bring in Stephen Hopkins, who remains one of my best friends. And that film was me and Stephen. I mean, Stephen, you know, we shared credit with another writer, but I never met the other writer. I guess he had been hired he was an editor who was also spoke French, and he literally translated the other draft into English, and therefore that got him a credit. But Stephen Hopkins hired me, and Stephen Hopkins and I basically spent months just working over that script. Just, you know, like, it's a shame he doesn't have his name on it for credit, because that's what he does with writers. He just sits there, and you go to his house, and you work all freaking day and night, and you just over and over and over, and that's a real director. You know, he's a hell of a director. It was a real passion project for him. And it was one of those films where everybody on it remains great friends. I mean, I would say Gene Hackman and Morgan Freeman to this day are good friends. I've had Morgan Freeman over the house many times, and I mean Steve and I are lifelong friends. So it's pretty cool.
Oh, that's so cool, man. Yeah, I love Stephen Hopkins. I think The Life and Death of Peter Sellers is fantastic.
Well, he was very, you know, I came upon you guys on Facebook. I saw your review for Blown Away, and I forwarded it to him and to Peter, you know, Levy, the DP, and those guys are best friends. And they were thrilled. They, you know, like, because you guys basically wrote the nicest review, because the film was not that well received, so they were just so happy to feel the love you guys gave.
Is amazing. That movie is amazing. It came out the same summer as Speed and True Lies, the summer of 94, and it got the short end of the stick. That movie has the greatest fucking explosion that I've ever seen in any movie in the history of
cinema. Not to mention Tommy Lee Jones singing a fucking U2 song.
The U2
song. That's so cool. Yeah,
that's cool. She's awesome, old school, unpretentious, throwback action flick that you don't get anymore. And honestly, I'd rather have Blown Away than any PG-13 scrubbed of the consequence action movie that's coming out, you know, next week. I second the love for Under Suspicion with Frank. The movie is awesome. It's totally underrated. Peter, I know the movie didn't get a very wide release. My buddy and I at the time when I was living in LA, we went to the theater and saw that shit opening night. And I can remember sitting there in a small theater in Santa Monica. I believe it was one of the theaters on the promenade or right off the promenade that it was playing. And I remember sitting there saying, damn, this movie is awesome. Like, this is just such a great thriller. And I believe Monica Bellucci, when she was like a relative unknown at the time, like she hadn't done too much in America, if I recall, she's in the film, right? Isn't?
Yeah. She's his wife.
It's just such
she was as lovely as can be. My hotel room in Puerto Rico was right next to her room. Boy, that was fun. Every time you would knock on, you know, we became friends. She's like right next door, right? And you know, and every time you'd knock on her door, I swear to God, she would take off her clothes and put on a towel, because she was always in a towel. Like, don't you ever wear clothes? And the answer was no. She's French. She's always naked. Like, I love you for that, Monica. Never change, you know. And,
yeah, she's crazy. Yeah, I mean, honestly, if those guys ever want to chat about Under Suspicion, Blown Away, we'd love to get you guys all on and chat.
Judgment Night, Predator 2. I own Predator 2 on Blu-ray.
Predator 2 has the trophy case sequence, one of the coolest things like in any like sci-fi movie ever.
You get the Elder Predator. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Peter, I want to ask too about your recently you had directed your first film, and most people I think know you from your screenwriting credits, but you are a director as well, and you've got a number of projects coming up in the future. What can you tell us about Rites of Passage, your first film you directed?
Well, Rites of Passage was like I mean, I really wanted to direct a film, and so I went out personally, and I, in the month of January, I made this decision, and the property that that film is shot on is owned by a dear friend of mine, and we were there together, just walking through those greenhouses, and I said, hey, Rick, if I put up $100,000, would you put up $100,000 too? We could, like, shoot a movie here? And he said, yeah. And we didn't have a script yet, and then I went out and I made like a 20-minute movie on some little, like, you know, Best Buy camera that I had for like $800. So I made a 20-minute movie that was just the world of the film. It didn't have a script yet. And I went out and I raised $2.6 million. I raised enough money to make an offer to Christian Slater. And I had gotten, you know, I've been working on something with Mark Canton, and I got Mark Canton to make the offer for me because, you know, he's legit. And once I got Slater, I was able to get everybody else very quickly and raised the 2.6 and had a movie. And, you know, I went to UCSB, so it was kind of an homage to Isla Vista. And I wanted to make a darkly comic pop thriller. And, you know, the problem that we had was that the Chumash, you know, basically hated what we had done. And even before they had seen the film, they protested the Isla Vista premiere, and about a dozen Chumash Indians were arrested at the premiere and taken away by police for violently, you know, like shouting and screaming and putting flyers in our car for being cultural prostitutes, they called us. They hadn't even seen the film. And, the Chumash Indians went on IMDb and they literally hacked my IMDb page and the IMDb page for the movie, and they put up a message of hatred of the film. And then they got like every Chumash on the planet to rate it like no stars. So, you know, because the film didn't get a wide release, it was kind of something that depended on reviews, and we just got. So it was like kind of like it was horrible. Like, we got all these horrible reviews, and the Chumash were after us, and they're hacking our websites. And it became really a nightmare, man. I realized
I can't believe that
I will
real.
Never go up against the Indians again. Those people they're tough, man. And back in the days, if you were a cowboy getting caught, like those Indians, they're mean mofos, man.
I haven't seen the film, but if you got a negative response from that movie, I would hate to think what possibly Eli Roth maybe just suffered over Green Inferno, potentially over his depiction of another tribal race.
I really love directing. It's so much fun. You know, as you get older, you rely on your instincts, and you just get everybody to do their best work. I'm looking forward to another shot. I'll be directing a short film here in Los Angeles starting on December 7th called King Me. And I'm working with Mark Kenton's company, David Hopwood. And it's about a homeless man who basically lives in the Venice Beach Carnival Walk. And he figures, it's too dangerous here. I want to go to Thousand Oaks where it's safe. And these two cops pick him up and they dump him in Skid Row downtown where it's really gnarly. And some reporter says, well, what if you wear a body camera and go back and, you know, provoke those cops in Thousand Oaks again, and we can like sue them. And this kind of drunken bum kind of like falls for this, and things go really bad. And it becomes a story about who's the villain, the cops, the reporter, the homeless person, or a society that has no answer for homelessness. And we hope to really do that kind of an art house provocative film that can get us to some festivals. So unlike Rites of Passage, you know, be an art house type of project. So I'm very excited about that.
Sounds good.
Absolutely. If you want to come back and talk about that when you have it out, we would be more than happy to have you on.
Well, thank you. And, I know we're running out of time, but I'd say it looks very good that my old movie Varsity Blues is going to become a TV series. It looks up Paramount Pictures Television. I've presented them a take that they love, and there's a network that we're there in negotiations right now. So that's very exciting. And
that's very
it looks like it's not a script, not a pilot, but a put series order. So that's a real life-changing, cool thing. And I just wrote this really cool, my first spec script in years, and I'm working with Alan Rich, who just did Southpaw. And it's the true story of Marine Captain Eric McElveeny. And Eric's a guy who came out of a Pittsburgh trailer camp and got himself into Annapolis Naval Academy and became a Marine Captain fighting over in Afghanistan. He stepped on an IED, blew his leg off, had to go through that whole trauma care of going back to Germany and Walter Reed and back to San Diego to a failing marriage. The experience made him put his marriage back together because he found faith. And then he found endurance training, and he became the fastest. He won the Ironman 22 months later as the fastest challenge athlete on the planet. And it's a great story. Wow. And I just wrote that, and we're looking forward to getting that one made very soon.
That sounds like it could be a very intense movie for everyone involved, especially whoever gets to play the lead role.
Well, you know, we're looking at Channing Tatum, and because it's the title's Captain Iron, and it's, you know, this guy is a really well-built stud with, like, beautiful ink tattoos on his body, and he's got this, he's kind of, you know, these guys are making their amputee, their prosthetic legs look sexy. They're kind of recreating the image of what used to be a victim to be, like, something like, hey, I'm a cyborg. I'm a freaking sexy cyborg, and I'm better than you. You know, so it's kind of interesting because all these Marines are getting blown up now. They're like 22, 23, 24 years old. They're not, you know, used to be that 80% of amputees are old men with diabetes. So it's really interesting what's happening with the whole amputee Marines IED thing. So I'm just very excited about that project, as you can imagine. And I sold a project to Wesley Snipes called 59 Rows of Teeth that Wesley's going to shoot. It's a more of a lower budget $5 million shoot. We're going to shoot in New Orleans come this second quarter of this year when he's done doing that new TV series, The Player. So I'm excited.
Oh, that's great, man. That's very cool. Wesley Snipes is awesome.
You know, he's playing he's producing it and he's playing the second lead, and it's like a Ratso Rizzo role. He plays a really kind of messed up old hitman. And it's a great dialogue piece for him. It's written to be like a David Mamet movie, so we're really excited.
Perfect.
About it.
Awesome.
That's way cool.
We always like to ask people, I know we're getting close on time, but what are some, outside of the movies, of course, you've had a chance to work on yourself, what are some of your favorite movies that you would watch any time of day or just, you know, off the top of your head, stuff that you enjoy?
Oh, my God. You know, if I ever get every chance I get to watch Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, my favorite movie of all time. You know, I mean, it's just that perfect fusion of like really well written, kind of funny, but really dire. I mean, you know, the stakes get pretty high. The Godfather, you know, I mean, that's always on that list. You know, Blade Runner, I've seen it 27 times. Really a fan of this recent year. You know, Killing Me Softly. I know that you're naming your podcast the Planet Words. I think that scene where Ray Liotta gets his ass handed to him is one of the best shot, most real sequences. It's a mind blower, and you know these movies that take a lot of time with dialogue, like a Quentin Tarantino and Jackie Brown, but they just really, it's all about the dialogue and these great actors taking their time to display their character in a long set piece scene. Love that kind of filmmaking. I'd like to do something like that. I just saw Jackie Brown over the weekend. I'm just reminded, oh my God, that scene when, you know, Samuel Jackson is convincing Chris Tucker to get the trunk of that car. It's like a 10-minute scene. It's freaking amazing.
Yeah,
we just
did a podcast on Jackie Brown, man, and I – Max Cherry is like my all-time favorite.
Oh
character.
My God, yeah, he's a great one. That shot when he sees her for the first time and she's walking—it's like a 5-minute shot. They just play that song, and it's just like what other filmmaker can do that? I mean, the pressure on guys like me to have a 110-page script and to keep the pace along, in the Hollywood system—you cannot write that kind of scene because you got to pace it up, and so. To see a director like Tarantino just like, I'm doing this my way. I don't care if it's a 3-hour freaking movie.
Right.
It's great.
No, man. For sure. Well, seriously, man, this has been a fantastic chat. If you ever want to come back on, you're more than welcome to discuss a project you have, or if you just want to discuss a different movie in general. If you want to come on and talk about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid or The Godfather, you're more than welcome.
Well, thanks, guys, and I appreciate it. As you know, I can talk all day, so thanks for being patient with me. And
yeah, no problem.
Oh, it's not even a question. Thank you. Thank you very much, Peter. Really, really was a treat to talk to you, you know, over Skype, and it just awesome, just totally mind blowing and crazy. And like Frank said, anytime, and you can bet I won't bother you, but we'll certainly keep in touch.
All right. Thank you very much. And one last thing I could plug: look for my first novel coming out. It's called Fast Flash to Bang Time, and I'm very excited.
Oh yeah, That's such an amazing. Say the title again. It's a great title.
It's called Fast Flash to Bang Time, and it's a military term for a short fuse on a bomb. But it's a great story about these two FBI agents who've been exiled to Vegas, which is kind of the gulag of FBI stations, because he's a crack addict who's keeping it secret, and she's addicted to sex. They both fell in the line of duty to their addictions, and they're sent out to Vegas, and in the line of duty, they come across a case where the family's been slaughtered and the killer took the baby. And this becomes the higher power for these two broken people to, like, gut it out and to save themselves and save each other so they can save the day. And it's like, it's just this rise out of darkness. It's not the descent, it's the rise out of darkness. And I had written the screenplay, and it's my most well-received screenplay. I've made millions and millions of dollars off this screenplay, because it's got me so many other jobs. But it's almost got me with John Travolta. It's almost got me with Gerard Butler, with Thomas Jane. And I realized it's not going to get made now, because they're just not making these dramas anymore at the studios. They only make them if it comes from a book. So I've literally had to write the book to essentially get the film jump-started. And now that I've written the book, now there's a multi-book deal for the characters, so I'll be able to continue writing more books about these two characters and their adventures. And so I'm really excited about it. And as a Hollywood screenwriter, it's really nice doing a book, because you get to kind of like rediscover the thrill of writing again, because you're kind of writing prose, you're kind of like on your own. And then you get to work with a pimpy New York book editor who really puts you to the paces and kind of makes you better and challenges you. It's a really fun process. So sorry to be shamelessly self-promoting, but I had to throw
that. No, listen.
No, man, I'm getting that book, and we'll peddle that book on our website.
Oh,
our
baby, Facebook. I love you. Thank you so much.
No problem, man. Okay. When's it coming out?
It won't be out. We're just making the deal now, so it probably won't be out till the summer, but it's coming. It's coming.
All right, awesome.
So I'm very excited about that.
That sounds great, man. Very cool.
Thank you so much again, guys. Adios. All right.
All right, take care, man. Thanks again.
All right, bye-bye.